Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's January 12th, 2018 program. Commercial real estate and marijuana. High times, high prices. Most segments of the Lane County commercial and industrial real estate market are doing well, but prices and rents are rising. Availability is spotty to non-existent in certain areas. Some say that the new cannabis industry is having a profound impact on the market and availability. Although there is ongoing disagreement about whether or not cannabis-related businesses are forcing other businesses out or preventing them from locating, there is evidence of great financial pressure to convert space from other uses to the cannabis industry. Today, we have two excellent speakers, with one with a background in commercial real estate, the other from the marijuana industry, from an association, to address these important issues. This is the 16th program in our 2017-2018 programming year. This is Sandra Bishop, City Club President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported organization and a nonprofit. Our members have a direct influence on public policy. To become a member, go to cityclubofeugene.org. And I have a special announcement today. We want to thank the Eugene Area Chamber of Commerce for hosting a dozen public school teachers from throughout the region this week in the first session of our course called Oh, the Places You Can Go, Careers in Lane County. City Club co-sponsors this free course for teachers with Lane Education Service District, Lane Workforce Partnership, and the Eugene Chamber. Up to 12 teachers will be meeting weekly through March, visiting different companies and workplaces to learn about the local economy and the great job opportunities it offers for high school graduates. City Club is the founding sponsor of this course. This is the seventh time the course has been offered since 2013. And I want to take the opportunity to thank Mary Layton for coordinating it and making it happen. Thank you, Mary. Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Sacred Earth Botanicals, University of Oregon Government and Community Relations, Summit Bank, and one of our Sapphire sponsors, George Rohde Repair Shops, providing car care with a conscience, with three repair locations in Eugene: Euro Asian Automotive, Stadium Automotive, and Auto House, or online at eugenerepairs.com. And special thanks to PacInfo and Simplified Computing LLC and KLCC Radio. Excuse me. City Club programs are broadcast on public radio station KLCC 89.7 at 6:30 on Mondays following the Friday program. The coordinator of today's program is Ralph Pledger. We'd like to thank Ralph for organizing this important discussion today, and I'd like to turn it over to Ralph to introduce our speakers. Thanks.
Well, greetings and good afternoon. Today we will have two speakers. The first speaker will be John Brown. And John Brown has been a commercial real estate professional since the 1970s. He's now a broker with the firm Evans, Elder, Brown, and Subert Commercial Real Estate. He's familiar with all aspects of the commercial real estate business. In addition, John has pursued many civic interests, including serving on the Eugene Water and Electric Board, Willamette Family Services Board, McKenzie River Watershed Council, and a number of other worthy entities. John's passion is the outdoors, especially fishing and related activities. He is dedicated to protecting the local environment and has worked to ensure clean waterways and, in particular, clean drinking water. John has lived in Eugene his entire life. He served in the U.S. Army with a tour in Vietnam. He is married to Kathy Rodman Brown, a former teacher in the School District 4J. Kathy and John have two grown children, and initially he said on his website it was two grandchildren, now it's four. all of whom reside in Oregon. So welcome, John. After John, Casey Houlihan will speak. Casey now serves as the Executive Director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association, which is known as ORCA, O-R-C-A, like a killer whale. That's kind of convenient, isn't it, Casey? They're based in Portland. The mission of ORCA is to create and support a thriving, safe, legal, and respected cannabis industry through lobbying, advocacy, and community organizing. Casey is a political consultant and organizer who has been actively involved in developing cannabis policy in Oregon for years, so he brings some serious knowledge to the subject. He led the statewide field campaign for Measure 91 with New Approach Oregon, and before that he worked with Democracy Resources to help qualify the measure for the ballot. He's worked as a labor organizer, a legislative assistant in the Oregon legislature, deputy communications director for two Eugene area representatives, and has worked on campaigns of many shapes and sizes across the country. He also consults for businesses statewide. Initially, we were planning to have Scott Lansfield, the owner of Tsunami Books, be the first questioner, but he had to back out due to some compelling business stresses. So at this point, I'll ask John Brown to take the microphone.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's a pleasure to hear to speak about real estate and the cannabis industry. And you know, in my background, I've done a lot of unique things. I mean, just to mention one was, many of you can remember Rajneesh Baram and the Bhagwan, and I was asked to appraise 96,000 acres, housing for 8,000 runways, offices and everything, and it was one of the most unique things I've ever done. And so the diversity of what I've done in the past is pretty good. But recently, when marijuana was legalized, first for the medical part, in our business we sell and we lease all property types. And what had happened with the medical part, it did not have a significant impact initially because there was a reluctance on both the people getting into the business and the real estate community and how they were going to rent to those people, because they still had the dichotomy between the federal regulations and the state regulations. And currently, you know, the real estate market is really strong. Part of that is attributed to the cannabis industry. I mean, some of the major factors right now in the entire overall market, there's strong in-migration, we've got low interest rates, we have short supply of buildable lands. The construction costs by some have increased almost 30% in the last 4 years, and we're going to see that continue, in my opinion, because we've got the Knight project coming online, Hayward Field renovation, just to name a few, and some other major projects, and a supply of skilled laborers, skilled contractors is very limited. If you don't believe me, call and ask to get a roof bid or have a roof replaced right now. Some of them are out a year. And that's a long time, especially if your roof's leaking and things such as that. But we have a really good inventory of skilled labor in the community, but they're very busy. The medical cannabis, when they first started, they had a little bit of a challenge because they couldn't get their license until they had a lease. And sometimes the licensing was taking 6 to 8 months. And plus they had this restriction that they couldn't be within a certain geographic proximity to another. So they didn't know who was going to be where. They didn't want to sign a 3 to 5 year lease, not knowing that they were going to get their permit. And so there was a kind of a catch 22. Do you want to go in and sign a 5 year lease for an intended use that you may not be approved for? And then you didn't know if somebody else within two blocks of you had already made an application, tied up a property, and they were 2 months ahead of you. And so it was a challenge. And so we didn't see the demand, the appreciation, and everything else like we have later. And a lot of the property owners were pretty much reluctant to lease to this new concept. They didn't know what type of clientele, they didn't know about the odors, and probably the big looming factor is again that difference between the state regulations and the federal regulations, because the vast majority of properties in our community have a mortgage. Almost 99% of those mortgages are federally insured. Anything federally insured has to comply with the federal law, and they cannot legally rent or finance something that has a cannabis outlet, whether it be production or retail sales. And so that was it. So technically, if you owned a building and you wanted to lease it to medical marijuana or even wholesale retail, you can't have a mortgage because they can call your mortgage if they find it. And the other problem is that people figured out that once when, if you don't have a mortgage, but you rent to a tenant, and then you want to sell, the buyer can't get financing because you have an illegal use in there and you can't break the lease. And so there was a lot of hurdles that this industry had to overcome, but they overcame them. And because when recreational cannabis was approved, you know, and I've been here doing this for a long time, the increase primarily in retail and industrial buildings is unprecedented. And I've been through three cycles when the properties have gone up and gone down, and we're going to go through another one. But what that did, especially to industrial buildings, was phenomenal because it increased rental rates and it increased sale prices per square foot significantly. Same thing for retail. Some studies I've seen where people have estimated it's affected them by a factor of 100%, 150% of rental rates increasing. Now, just as a caveat there, you got to remember that value is not a fact to be found, it's an opinion. The market will tell us what value is. And so if people were paying $10,000 a year in rent and it's gone up to 20, maybe that 10 should have been 15. You just don't know where they start. And so there's a lot of subjectivity in that. But I, in my market activity and what I have seen, I can absolutely tell you that the prices went up way disproportionate than other property types. And I believe it was because of this limited number of opportunities that the cannabis industry could locate in. So when they went into the industrial buildings, one of the biggest criteria was heavy power. The more power, the better, because it's very expensive to increase the power, but they needed a lot of power. So buildings with excessive amounts of power saw a premium. We used to sell industrial buildings for $50 to $60 a square foot, land and building, with a reasonable land to building ratio. Now we can sell them for anywhere from 80 to 100. It's been phenomenal. Rental rates in industrial buildings have gone from, and we speak monthly, 30 to 40 cents to 50 to 70 cents. And that's had an impact on a lot of people. I mean, just as recently as yesterday, over the internet, there was two requests for people wanting industrial buildings, but the very first caveat they put there is not cannabis, because because sometimes people won't even respond to it because of that challenge. So the other things that we've seen is that cannabis industry, for the most part, have been professional. They've done a good job, and they've respected the laws. In my observations, they've done a pretty good job of it. But again, their opportunities to find these locations are limited. There are some landlords that know they have a mortgage, and I've seen them do this, and they just, when you have in the lease, you say, what is your intended use? They said, put down retail sales. You know they're going to sell pot. They're going to sell marijuana, excuse me. But they just kind of turn the blind eye and say that's okay because they're getting a rent premium for it. Another challenge that you have is that most, if not all, title companies in the state of Oregon will not insure a title for a sale or anything. Now they have a disclaimer that says if this property is known to be used for the sale or production of cannabis, or that they will not insure title. And that is huge because nobody's going to buy a property that they can't insure title with. So there's all of these things that have happened in the market. But, you know, to summarize it, the industrial market and the retail market have both been significantly impacted, in my opinion, by this industry. And whether that's good or bad is, you know, that's a perspective that you that's personal. If you're a building owner, it's great because your rents have gone up. If you're a tenant and you're trying to find available space, is it right? Is it an anomaly? But there's an old saying that excess profit breeds ruinous competition. I think, the speaker following me, I've listened to some and have seen some of his statistics, and they're really, really interesting, and I really can't wait to hear what else he has to say. But just the number of per capita and things are really quite alarming about what our community has done. A few examples of what's happened here that I have experienced, and there was when the first month that recreational cannabis was approved, we had a building in Springfield for lease, and we were asking $2,400 a month for it. The people came in and said, we want that, and they offered us $6,000 a month, and they prepaid it in cash. And that was before we were smart enough to say, you know, we can't take it. We just took this bag of cash and we gave it to the owners, and however they got it deposited was their business. But as you know, that any deposits over a certain amount, you know, some think it's $10,000, some think it's $7,500, are automatically turned in to the IRS about, you know, where is this money coming from. And so that stopped real quickly, at least in our business. We no longer accept cash. We just ask for a check and things such as that, because it's a, you know, banking is also a challenge in that industry, I understand. Another thing that, you know, we've listed some buildings, like I said, normally $50, $60 a square foot. So we just said, let's test the market. We put one out at 90, and in 2 weeks, it was at full price escrow. And there's nothing unique about it. It was just an industrial building. It was less than 10,000 square feet, and it sold immediately. One of the examples that I have, too, is you may remember HMT Technology and Langenberg Water is a little over 110,000 square foot building in West Eugene. Eugene Water and Electric Board bought it. We were going to move some of our operations there if we thought we were going to sell the headquarters building, a long story. It didn't happen, so we sold it. And it sold to marijuana operations for cannabis production, and it was condominiumized because I believe that there's a restriction on can't have one production site more than 10,000 square feet. And so they parsed it into 10 particular geographic portions, made a big condo in it, and I believe it's still probably operating as that. I don't know, but I assume it is. Another, you know, just these examples are continue, but we had an former armored car facility, and it was perfect for the cannabis industry. It had bulletproof window, it had 3 vaults, it had the greatest security, greater than any lending institution I know of, had an exhaust system, and we put it out at $4,400 a month. In the first day, I had an offer for $8,000. I mean, they recognized that. Fortunately, the owner said that I don't want to take that chance. There was no mortgage, and they didn't want to do it. And the other side of that is we leased it to a company that now employs 23 people at that location in a traditional industrial operation. And lastly, on the real estate examples is I just saw a listing of a property that's 33 acres in a home, which according to the people that sell that, it would sell maybe for $350,000. It's on the market for $1.6 million because it has a tier 2 approval for cannabis production and nothing else unique about it other than that. And the counter side of that, and $1.6 million is a lot of money. The counter side of that, a person in my office yesterday listed 33 acres just north of Eugene approved for cannabis production for $3,500 a month to rent it. So there's a real disparity in where it's going and where it's been, but in the end, it's had a significant impact. I made an inquiry to a local utility company, and I asked them, and I know Casey and I talked about this, I said, do you have any statistics about how much your utility load has increased since the legalization of marijuana? Of recreational, and they did some checking and things, and based upon the permits in the last 2 years that they know that have where the increased load and demand has come from the production, as the growth has been 20%. Half of that was for marijuana and or for production of cannabis, and it increased for the 2 years $1 million in revenue to the utility. And so that was, a pretty significant impact. And they asked that I not disclose which one it was. And, you know, to summarize this, that there's a lot of other kind of collateral things that could happen. I won't get into too much detail because the assessor is, the way they assess property in Oregon is very complex. And I don't want to give you too much, but basically when a property sells, if it's on the market, if the county says it's worth $1 million and it sells for $2 million, that's a pretty significant increase, and that's what's happened. These prices have gone up significantly. Well, that's how they change one of the values on your tax statement. If you look at your market value, it's not statutorily goes up at 3%. It goes up whatever that differential is. And so if a lot of the sales are going up disproportionately than everything else, they can turn around and take your market value, if it was $1 million, and say everything's selling for two, then they raise it, and they raise it significantly. And so many of those buildings that may not even be directly affected by cannabis production could inadvertently see an increase in that value. It may not be an increase in the taxes. It depends on the relationship between market value and assessed value. But a long story short, this can distort the market. You know, you could turn around and have even an appraiser go in and say, wow, everything's selling for $100 a foot. You got to remember, if he picks every sale that happened to have a cannabis-related industry in it, that may skew the market for somebody that's trying to sell lumber and plywood, because they can't, so far, pay this rent. It's been a fun thing to look at. It's only a couple years old, and I'm sure it's going to level out. But right now, there are a lot more retail outlets that I know of that have yet to be open, but they've leased buildings and they haven't gotten their approval yet. So, kind of to summarize this, it's definitely, in my opinion, increased the demand for retail and industrial properties. It's increased rental rates and sale prices for properties of this character, both retail and industrial. But I still believe it's going to be short-lived. I think there's going to be a leveling of the market, and they're going to come back down. But that's yet to be said. And this recent ruling that I think Casey is going to talk about, Department of Justice, and how they interpret the laws may have an effect. It may not. But it's an evolving thing. It's certainly had an impact on the market. And it's as if our job wasn't tough enough beforehand, it's just made another dynamic in it, and it's been fun and challenging. And so with that, I'll turn it over to Casey and let him take the statistical part of this. Thank you.
Thanks, John. Hello, everyone. My name is Casey Houlihan. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association, or ORCA. I also handle Pacific Northwest development for BDS Analytics, which is a market research firm and data analytics firm operating in the cannabis space. It's where we're getting some of the figures that I'm going to be using throughout this presentation. ORCA currently represents over 200 businesses statewide. We're predominantly representing retail businesses, although we also have members who are producers, processors, wholesalers, distributors, or ancillary businesses whose goal is to support our broader mission of creating a vibrant and robust retail cannabis marketplace here in Oregon. I want to agree with quite a bit of what John had just mentioned in regards to the impact on real estate prices, although I will say that certainly in this area, Eugene and Lane County more broadly, that it has been somewhat of an outlier compared to other areas in the state, and indeed compared to other states that have moved forward with legalization as well. Other states like Washington and Colorado, especially after several years of having their industries normalize, have found positive ripple effects on both real estate prices as well as other ancillary businesses, lawyers, construction, et cetera, that are all required to get a new industry like this up and off the ground. But unlike Oregon, and certainly like what we've seen in Eugene, these changes have been more consistent, they've been slower, they've been over time. And here we're seeing just a lot more turbulence that's obviously leading to some of the issues that he'd mentioned. I wanted to actually just unpack some of what we'd heard before and give a little bit of a history of how we got here. As some of you know, the state's history of regulating cannabis dispensaries, whether that's for adult use or medical, has been somewhat trepidatious, and it's all happened relatively quickly over the last several years. Prior to 2014, it really depended on which locality a dispensary had been located in and the extent to which local law enforcement there tolerated them. Now, in the city of Portland, they've reliably had dispensaries for medical purposes from, say, 2010 and onward, but the city didn't consider it an enforcement priority. In Eugene, we did see some stores beginning to open in 2012 and 13, although some of them were shut down by state and local law enforcement at the time. And it wasn't until the legislature passed House Bill 3460 in 2013 that they began creating a process to license these medical businesses. And in March of 14, that was when the applications went live on the internet at, I believe, March 3rd, 8:30 a.m., and everyone lined up to apply online at once. It was first come, first serve, and that was also the metric that was used to determine who got which locations, depending on where people were applying for, and how those 1,000-foot buffers between stores would be applied. Now, these were all stores that were licensed as medical at the time, so this was an application through the Oregon Health Authority, and part of their rules included a 1,000-foot buffer from any schools, as well as a 1,000-foot buffer from any other licensed dispensary. Later in the year, in the fall of 14, when Oregon voters overwhelmingly passed Measure 91, that obviously changed and we needed to re-examine that. And in 2015, the legislature explored how to allow the OLCC to begin licensing these shops and create a smoother transition for existing medical dispensaries to become legal adult-use cannabis businesses. That also included early sales, which they added on in the 2015 legislative session, which allowed folks 21 and over to begin making legal adult use purchases through existing medical dispensaries in the fall of 2015. When that transition occurred finally in the tail end of 2016 and the beginning of 2017 from the Oregon Health Authority to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, the 1,000-foot buffer between retail shops was no longer in rule. That had been in rule on the medical side, but was not a requirement on the adult use side. And instead, that decision to determine whether or not to keep that buffer was kicked to cities and counties or municipalities. The overwhelming majority of them in the state chose to retain that 1,000-foot buffer. And as a consequence, the maps that had already been pretty well established at that point of where cannabis businesses could be located was largely set in stone. It was really only in the Eugene area that we saw so much turbulence early on, because without that 1,000-foot buffer, it opened up a great deal more locations that could technically be licensable. This is one of the many ways that Oregon was very unique compared to other areas as well in terms of how we implemented our legalization. Colorado very strictly limited the number of retail licenses that they'd issued, and especially had included a smooth segue for existing medical cannabis businesses to make it into their new regime. Washington had limited them even further and actually had enacted a lottery system that ultimately required a very high barrier to entry cost-wise for applicants. Oregon did not do these things, and as a result, we were able to allow a much greater swath of folks into our industry here. The mom-and-pop businesses that never would have had a shot to get online in any of the other states actually had an opportunity to do so here. The problem was, it also created a brief window after Oregon had legalized marijuana, but before other states had, where Oregon became ground zero for folks that were looking to get a foothold on the retail cannabis industry in particular. And further, since everybody's attention nationally had already been focused on Oregon, people could see that Eugene was by far the biggest city in the state that did not have this 1,000-foot buffer, and as a result had basically no limit on how many stores could be opened in that area. And that's the reason why we've seen this drive over the course of the last year and a half of folks opening up more and more stores. I do think that we've seen that window since shut somewhat as other states get online and as California gets their legal regime up and running. Certainly once East Coast states get their systems up and running as well, we should see this pressure reduce even further. But that had been by far the biggest driver of that increase in interest in Oregon over the last year and a half, and particularly in Eugene. I think the removal of the buffer, I should say the decision by the city council here to not retain the buffer, was probably the biggest factor that had directly contributed to that extreme saturation. And it's obviously now badly hurting the local industry. Eugene at present has over 50 active cannabis retailers operating in the city limits. It's one of the highest densities of pot stores in the world, and with even more retailer applications currently pending. Several retailers led a push in 2016 to establish the buffer here in town, but the council determined that it was ultimately better not to meddle, that a buffer struck many of them as seeming protectionist, and that the free market would ultimately sort it out. On a long enough timeline, this may be true, but very little about this highly unstable situation resembles a free market, and the large fluctuations in retail prices and real estate prices, rather, is a consequence of this massive influx of folks. The buffer was not a protectionist move. The buffer was meant to slow down or stop the green rush that so many had worried about of these folks coming into the state to establish these businesses, hoping to get a foothold that they could take elsewhere. Many of these interests also were extremely financially supported and were in a position where they could open up a retail business that lost money for a prolonged period of time with the aim of putting out of business the existing mom-and-pop shops that have been here for some time already. As a result, competition in Oregon's cannabis industry has been fierce at the retail level, in Eugene in particular. My association had gone on record advocating that the city enact the buffer, saying that the number of retailers in the county could more than double. That was about a year and a half ago, and it's since more than doubled. Shops were already going out of business at the time, even when it was still early sales of adult use cannabis through the medical marijuana dispensaries. And that was because competition had already reached a bit of a saturation point before everything had even transitioned to the OLCC. Now, many of those businesses that forged Oregon's industry in the first place are struggling to stay alive. Portland, which did choose to keep the buffer, is still a highly competitive retail cannabis market, but not to the extreme that Eugene is, and the market is much more stable there. There's lower turnover, less of a real estate bubble that people are seeing occur, People are getting to hold down their jobs longer. There's a fixed number of benefits that can be brought in from a particular region from taxing and regulating cannabis sales by way of jobs, tax revenue, et cetera. And adding more retail locations doesn't necessarily increase these benefits. I wanted to provide a little perspective as well about the density that we're experiencing here in this region, even relative to other parts of the state. There's 288 total active retail shops right now in Multnomah, Washington, and Clackamas counties combined for a combined population of approximately 1.7 million people. Works out to about one shop for every 5,900 people. Lane County has 97 shops for approximately 360,000 people, or one per 3,700 people. And in the city of Eugene, it's about one per 3,300. And that number will go lower as more stores get online. Colorado has 509 retailers for adult-use cannabis sales, currently active, for a statewide population of 5.5 million. That's one per about 10,000 people. And Washington has 395 stores for a statewide population of 7.2 million, which is about one per 18,000. It's estimated that as California gets their legal system online, they're going to be looking at a ratio of approximately one store for every 50,000 people. According to sales data from BDS Analytics, in October of 2017, Washingtonians bought $76 million of cannabis from their 395 state-licensed stores, or approximately $190,000 per store in gross sales per month. Coloradans and tourists bought $121 million from their state's 509 retail shops, or approximately $230,000 per month in sales. Oregon has more stores than either, with 516 active retailers for our population of about 4.1 million people. And we did $45 million in sales that month, which works out to approximately $88,000 in sales per store. Now, the density in Eugene is also about twice the statewide average here in Oregon, so I suspect that means that a great many of these retail stores are struggling with sales that are maybe as much as half of that figure, possibly even less. Oregon's approach, I feel, is still better than a lot of what the other states did, even if we are seeing some of these businesses struggle on their way up. I think that the way that we were able to provide more opportunities for more folks to enter the industry, especially with the long tradition that we've had here of folks operating in that space, was by far the better approach. I can't tell you how many folks we'd seen come down from Washington that missed out on their lottery and were just moving on to the next space that they could try to apply. I think that the way that we chose to allow the existing participants in that economy here to get first access and the ability to allow them to enter the system early on is one of the things that ultimately will make our state's legal regime one of the more successful in the country. The effect on real estate prices has been especially acute, as we mentioned earlier and as John was talking about, on the retail side. And since that's the type of license whose locations are the most limited, firstly with the school buffers and then secondly with whatever local regulations or additional buffers were put in place. And we're seeing the most dramatic increases in rents and prices in areas like Eugene, or Eugene in particular, where they did not choose to keep that buffer. Other state and zoning regulations or restrictions do tend to also be responsible for the artificial limiting and the availability of licensable real estate properties, as John had mentioned as well. Certainly some counties that have been fighting about whether or not to allow production on rural residential lands has been a thorn in the side of many growers in the area. Certainly the retail has been the bulk of the focus by way of local regulations and limiting it, and especially since any location that is technically commercially zoned and doesn't have a school nearby could be licensed, that had been the driver in Eugene bringing in most of those folks. The one other thing I definitely wanted to point to before I wrapped up was the elephant in the room on this, which I believe John had inferred earlier as well, federal prohibition. Now, this is still one of the drivers of most of the setbacks that the cannabis industry continues to face this day and age. The biggest limitation on our industry, period, because it's driving up the costs. There's sections of the tax code that prohibit cannabis businesses from taking most standard business deductions on their tax, with the exception of cost of goods, the Schedule I narcotics that we're not supposed to be selling. But in addition to that, it's also the reason that we don't have access to traditional banking services. It's what requires a great deal of these transactions to be cash only in the first place. And as John had also mentioned, it's one of the things that limits a great number of potential landlords from even offering these types of buildings available for rent in the first place, based on concerns that they may have the property pulled or, you know, somehow taken by the federal government if there were some type of enforcement action, which certainly from the news that we've seen in the last couple of weeks is a lot more of a realistic possibility than we'd thought maybe a year ago or two. And it remains unclear the extent to which the Department of Justice plans on intervening in any of the state legal business activity here in Oregon. What we do know is that's part of the factor that's driving the premium on these property locations. The other factor to consider, and that also makes Oregon's industry fairly unique, is for decades we've already been one of the nation's leading illicit exporters of cannabis, and legalization didn't change that. Instead, a wealth of highly skilled, highly experienced growers rushed to enter a regulated system. Many are now investing, hoping to be first to market when federal policies do change and allow for exporting cannabis into other states, even if that means having to survive in the far smaller Oregon-only market till then. It stands to reason that Eugene is the focus of this attention, since the southern Willamette Valley is such an ideal climate for growing, and it's such a part of the history and culture of Eugene. Others will keep doing what they've been doing, because there's a great many folks that were still not able to transition into our state's legal regime for any number of reasons, whether that was regulatory or financial or personal. And that means we're still going to have a great many folks that are operating outside of that space, which does increase access at the consumer level to illicit market product, which does suppress legal market purchasing from licensed retail stores. This is one of the other bottlenecks on our state's legal industry right now, and it's one of the trickier to fight without reenacting some form of prohibition or involving law enforcement to go around and, you know, begin arresting folks for selling pot again, which is not the direction that we would like to take things. There was a bill in the Oregon legislature last year that had aimed to fix some of these issues, or at least to help relieve some of the pressure of folks operating in a saturated system here in the state, which would have allowed for the exporting of excess cannabis from legal producers into other states where they would need it, where it is also legal and where Oregon shares a border. This was particularly with Nevada in mind. After a couple of months ago, after implementing their state legalization program, their governor announced a weed state of emergency when they ran out of weed. So we thought we might be in a position to help them as good neighbors. But unfortunately, that bill didn't make it much further than the Senate Judiciary Committee and died shortly thereafter due to concerns over a federal response and that that type of legislation could provoke it. But we have a lot of good folks, including Senator Floyd Prusansky here in Eugene, who have been holding that fight up for a long time and who I expect will continue to push for sensible legislation like that that'll allow Oregon to remain at the top of the pack when it comes to developing our state's cannabis industry. The only thing I wanted to add at the end is that no one, from what I can tell, has been helped by a boom and bust cycle of cannabis businesses coming through town. I think that the explosive growth that this industry is seeing can definitely be promising and can definitely be harnessed for good in communities, but taking a completely laissez-faire approach and allowing everyone to come in from everywhere to try to drive out the local businesses is not an effective strategy, has not been a very helpful strategy for cultivating a thriving economy here in the sector of the market. I do agree that on a long enough timeline, this will get sorted out, but I do think that what we're creating is a great deal of turbulence in the meantime. Turnovers for employees, turnovers for buildings, increase in property sales for these businesses that go bust. Because as you can see, based on other places, we have an unsustainable number of retail stores here in the community at the moment, and it is likely that they will not all survive. I do think overall, though, that the implementation of legalization here in the community has definitely been a good overall, certainly for the additional jobs, certainly for the additional tax revenue, and if only for the regulation that now prevents these products from being sold to children or in parks or without labels or without testing. And that overall, this is just one minor setback that I believe the industry will overcome, and that ultimately will work out to Eugene's favor once some of the particulars of the acute concerns have been realized. Thank you.
Very interesting. So we're going to now take a 5-minute break to formulate questions around each table, and then we'll return with audience questions. Remember, only City Club members are allowed to ask questions at the microphone. We'll be back in 5 minutes. Thanks.
This is KLCC Eugene 89.7, KLCO Newport 90.5, 89.1 KLFR Reedsport, and at 88.1 KLFO Florence, KMPQ Roseburg, KLBR Bend. KLCC is a service of Lane Community College. We're on Facebook and Twitter and online at klcc.org.
Welcome back to the January 12th, 2018 City Club program. Commercial real estate and marijuana, high times, high prices. City Club is a nonprofit organization Support for City Club is provided by our members and sponsors, including Sacred Earth Botanicals, University of Oregon Government and Community Relations, Summit Bank, George Rohde Repair Shops, and special thanks to our in-kind sponsors, University of Oregon Academic Extension, Dot Dotson's Photography, and KRVM 91.9 Radio. Before we go to member questions, please remember, keep your questions relevant to the topic and short and to the point. Thank you.
Jerry Smith, City Club member. What I didn't hear was, if this is a booming business, and it sounds like it is, how much revenue is coming to the city, to the county, and to the state in terms of new business? That right now, they're unable to fund even shelter for disabled people waiting for Social Security for 2 years to provide their benefit.
This is Casey Houlihan. That's a great question. I believe that some of those funds have already begun being distributed back to the cities and counties. There had been some complications when the state was collecting a lot of those funds in the first place for the initial cannabis sales taxes, which I believe had to be based on the biennium before they could be begin distributed. That, I believe, was amended in the last legislative session, and those funds have since been distributed. The amount that the states brought in wildly exceeded our initial revenue estimates, which I believe had called for, and this was a while ago, so I apologize if this isn't exactly right, but somewhere in the range of 18 or so million for the first biennium, and I believe instead in the first year we brought in over $60 million in taxes. So something like 800% higher than what the state was originally anticipating. From there are certain percentages that do get distributed back to cities and counties. Additionally, the 3% local sales tax that communities have had the option to add, and virtually all communities did add, to cannabis sales does go directly back to those communities, and they have their own sovereignty to determine what those are spent on. So it's not clear to me what those exact figures are for the city of Eugene and Lane County. I know that by the time that they ended up divvied up to the localities, the state portion of those funds does tend to be fairly minuscule, certainly in terms of being able to do something substantive about homelessness or any of the other problems facing the community. I do think that certainly there might be more opportunity to do that with the local share of tax revenue, but that's something that you'd need to speak with the city council here about to determine where it's going presently and, you know, how it may be better utilized.
Great, thank you.
Hello, my name is Mariah Learn, and I'm almost embarrassed to ask this question since I've lived here since 1975. But would you be willing to please tell us what exactly are these products? What products are being sold, and what are the differences in these products? I personally don't know what they are.
I don't think we're looking at John.
Casey Houlihan again. I guess I'll take that one. That's another excellent question. One of the things that I have access to in my role that I'd mentioned before with BDS Analytics, the market research firm, what we do is we track sales data and sales trends to determine what it is exactly that folks are buying at the consumer level and for how much and how often and so on. So we do actually get a fair amount of information on that in pretty accurate detail. So what we're still seeing is that most consumers are still purchasing just flower, should just be the raw cannabis flower from the plant trimmed to smoke as flower. Some of the other areas that are becoming very popular in the industry tend to be extracts, concentrates, which is when people will take the whole plant or flowers or other parts of the plant, run it through some type of solvent, whether that's butane or CO2 or any number of other rigs under pressure and temperature to get a oil or resin type of a product that contains the active components of the cannabis plant. Those are then either consumed on their own, or they can be put into edibles, or one of the faster growing segments of the market now is the vaporizer cartridges. You may see people walking around with those very discreet little vape pens that are very popular these days. As well, edibles is also a very popular category where folks are able to go in and buy a certain metered dose edible that they know will have a very specific and consistent effect. But there's also, I suppose, the other major category would be topicals, where folks are also able to get lotions or salves or what have you that also have a very powerful analgesic effect locally wherever it's applied without having a psychoactive effect. Those typically tend to be the major categories of products that people are buying, but there are limitless subcategories and superclasses of other products within that. And it's a rapidly developing economy, too. So there's a lot of R&D happening right now that's leading to more and more products reaching store shelves every day. We recently saw that one business in town here is actually bringing a metered dose inhaler to market as well. So, like I said, new things every day.
Thank you.
I'm Jack Dresser. That's an impressive array. It sounds like it's getting almost as versatile as wheat, you know? My question is only tangential to the economics, but as a alcohol harm reduction research scientist, I developed training programs for alcohol servers in conformity with Oregon's alcohol server training program. So I've had a lot of dealings with OLCC that has to approve these programs. I was wondering what the regulatory regimen for this that OLCC uses, if you could describe it briefly. I know with alcohol, it's a very detailed set of criteria that has to be met. So.
Thank you. Casey Houlihan again. There are a lot of similarities between the requirements for folks that are going to be working in the cannabis industry, especially those that are going to be hands-on with folks that would be serving alcohol. And similarly, the OLCC does have a program set up where you can go online and you can participate, I believe, in a short quiz. And if you pass, then you get your bud tender, marijuana handler's card is the term that they're using for it now, bud tender being the colloquial term for folks working at a lot of the retail shops. So that requirement, and I actually believe that some of the training materials that they used in preparing both that quiz, that exam, and the certificate itself drew heavily from the alcohol requirements, especially with regards to checking IDs for folks that could potentially be underage. By far the biggest priority of the state is to make sure that that doesn't happen, as we recently saw from a series of decoy purchases that the OLCC put on throughout a number of cities in the state. That remains the highest priority, certainly, of our folks in the Oregon Retailers of Cannabis Association as well, to make sure that these are the types of problems we're able to avoid and that we can hopefully hold ourselves to an even higher standard than what we're currently seeing for alcohol.
Ruth Daimler. And our table has been concerned about the opiate crisis. We were wondering, since there's such a large use, it appears, of marijuana in our state, has that meant that there's a related reduction in the amount of opiate use, or would you know that?
Thank you, Casey Houlihan. That was another great question, actually, too, and one of the things that I'd like to point out is we've seen remarkable success with folks that are actually utilizing marijuana as a pathway away from opiates. The research on this has actually been very promising in recent months and years. I do think that we're going to learn a lot more in the coming years as some of the stigma around allowing this type of research to take place dissipates. One of the things that I do know that is still current, I believe, is that states that have access to medical marijuana programs, not even full adult use, just medical marijuana programs, have 26% lower rates of opioid-related deaths. And I think that if there was any one other public policy change that states would enact to drop opioid-related deaths by 26% overnight, they would do it in a heartbeat. So while I don't have the current figures on where Oregon sits specifically with regards to opioid-related deaths, I do know that that's still true across the board in this country, and that just increasing access to medical marijuana to the folks that could find benefit in it will definitely provide alternatives to folks that are otherwise falling addicted to, you know, these dangerous pharmaceuticals.
Thank you.
Ray Somatic, City Club member since 2014. John, I have a question for you. Eugene is not notorious for having a lot of nice, smaller retail spaces available that are ready to be built out and occupied. I wonder if you have a sense of what retailers are being shut out right now because there are so many cannabis retailers looking for locations that could be used for other forms of retail.
Yes, thank you. That's a great question, John Brown. Just to some of the experience in some geographic locations that you may relate to, 25th and Willamette, the former bowling alley is now retail. And if you look at the cost to create all of these, plus, you know, the larger the space, the greater the economy. And so there's a lot of the smaller retails. We get calls for people that want 500 to 1,000 square feet. It doesn't exist because the cost of developing a space is, you know, the dry areas are half as much as the wet areas. And so each individual space has to have a restroom and maybe a coffee bar and things such as that. And so when you spread that cost up a smaller space, the rent you have to achieve makes it not financially feasible. And so the trend has been, because very few new retail spaces have come online in Eugene in the last decade, and you're seeing a lot of the big boxes are now shutting down, and that's a trend that's going to continue. So a lot of the small startup companies, the little people that have developed a niche in the market, but they want to expand, it's a quantum leap to go from a small home occupation to a retail outlet because of the cost. And the cost, and like I say, in the size of the space, and the existing spaces are staying, and they're the ones where the majority of the cannabis have gone, the affordable ones, because they may be the ones that have the mortgages paid off. The newer ones have new mortgages, and there's that disconnect. So it's cutting out a lot of the smaller people. So thank you.
Actually, my question's for Mr. Brown, too. We've talked mostly about the retail space issue. I have heard there have
do
been...
Do you want to introduce
oh,
yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I always forget to do that. I'm Marty Wilde, past president, City Club, member since 2010. On the indoor industrial grow side, I have heard of similar impacts, but only anecdotally. And then on the outdoor agricultural space, have we seen any impacts on pricing as much?
Yes, John Brown. On the indoor spaces, like I indicated earlier, we've seen industrial buildings go from, and this is a generalization, but from $50 and $60 a square foot to close to $100. And like I say, I sold one in an outlying community. It was 7,800 square feet, sold it for $750,000. They put $250,000 worth of electrical upgrades and ventilation and lighting. And I got some numbers on the math and what they were doing in the production before the market was kind of oversaturated. And I think they were generating $1.2 million a quarter and do five crops a year. And their operational expense ratio was less than 20% of their overhead. So you can do that math. It was very profitable. It's had a significant impact. There's been numerous buildings that have been purchased and then licensed and then resold. And so right now there is an extreme shortage of available, affordable industrial space. New industrial space, like I said, the cost of construction has gone up greater than rents, generally speaking, with the exception of production space. And the cost of creating the electricity is quite so. So in the improved environment in the buildings, that's difficult. As far as the farmland, the example I gave where we might have thought that without that approval it would be $400,000, and it's listed at $1.6 million, that may be an indication of what that permit may be worth. But right now there's a lot of properties that are licensed. There's a lot of outdoor grows operations. We've sold two or three nurseries that have very familiar names, and now they are in the production of cannabis. So it's not having a profound effect on farmland prices. Most of the ryegrass land and things have been converted to hazelnuts, and those prices have gone up more than they would have for ryegrass. But I haven't seen any demonstrable appreciation in the farm ground. So it's just a perception.
This is Casey Houlihan again. I actually just wanted to add to that very quickly as well, especially with regards to the reselling of a lot of these properties that have since gone on to get approval or licensure. In many of the cases, the transaction is likely not only for that property as much as it is for basically at that point a functioning business, or at least the groundwork for a functioning business. And certainly in the example that John just gave, if you have a situation where a licensed grow facility could be turning around something like $1.4 million in revenue a quarter, which I imagine is not the case now that some of the wholesale numbers have changed pretty significantly. But at that point, if you're adding, you know, $800,000 or $1 million to the price of a property that's turnkey and good to go, you're not necessarily just buying the property, and the increase doesn't necessarily just reflect the increase in the value of that property. It also reflects in many ways what the earning potential of that property is, the same way that you would price timberland differently depending on the value of what's on it. So I see it as not entirely a cut and dry issue in that capacity. I also think that especially for some of the industrial spaces closer to town, this is where some of the regulations come into play again, because it's placed such a premium on buildings that meet all of the zoning criteria in the cities and counties that have allowed those types of businesses in those types of zoning. So again, it's very narrow filter that things are being applied through that does drive these prices up.
Great, thank you.
Paul Thompson, a City Club member for quite a while. This is a question for you, John. The city has just gone through the agony of increasing its urban growth boundary to include more industrial land. What's the relationship between that activity and the demand that's being placed on industrial land by the cannabis?
John Brown, Well, the primary areas that we've increased the UGB are west of Highway 99 and north in the Clear Lake Road, Airport Road area. The challenge there is that's not going to, in my opinion, meet the immediate demand. It's not served. There's a lot of wetlands. It's going to take a lot of fill. There's going to be a decade before you see that happen. We have a lot of land that's between Highway 99 and the railroad tracks that can be redeveloped and that's served, that's going there. But they still have wetlands issues. They have service issues. And until just recently, they couldn't hook up to services unless they were contiguous to the city limits. But they've overcome that. But I think the expansion of the urban growth boundary is not going to have an immediate impact on the availability of affordable industrial land.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Mary Layton, City Club member since 2006. So I'm not sure exactly who can answer this question, but I find that I'm kind of freaked out by the whole cash economy thing, traditional as it may be with marijuana. The fact that banks cannot loan money, that everything has to be done in cash, the tax situation becomes irregular. Do you think that the ordinary market and economic pressures of an orderly society will eventually overcome some people's distaste the way they did for alcohol, for the marijuana industry, and help get these things under control? I mean, I really do worry about gangs and dark money, as some people say, that the cash economy is going to cause us a lot of trouble, and that most law-abiding citizens will push back to bring marijuana back into the cash economy so we can tax it, for example.
I'm not sure what the question was, and we're running out of airtime, so we only have about 1 minute for the response. So
might regular conventions push that direction?
Thank you. This is Casey Houlihan. I'll try to be brief. I think that that's a valid point. I think that these holdups that we're seeing because of the conflict between state and federal laws are not ultimately sustainable. I think that the problems stemming mostly from cash have more to do with the illicit market in the state that is still very active, and it's a whole other issue for us to try to wrangle that in once we are allowed to export out of state. Before then, we're still just stuck in this kind of in-between gray area. I will say that there is currently one bank in the state, it's a credit union actually, based in Salem, that does knowingly and openly do business with cannabis businesses. They do follow the additional federal guidelines to allow for those types of businesses to have accounts, but they're extremely strenuous requirements to make sure that people have all their due diligence in order. And even then, it's not a cheap account to maintain either. That said, several of the members of our association utilize it because it does beat using a don't ask, don't tell system with another financial provider and getting the call that you have to come down and get everything out of your account in a paper bag that day. I do think that some of the pressures that this situation creates will ultimately help our case in the push for federal legalization and the push for repealing some of these more prohibitive elements of federal policy. But until then, these are the realities of the situation, and the folks in our industry don't seem to be afraid of doing what they need to do to make sure that they can follow the rules and make sure that their businesses survive.
Thank you very much. Before we thank our speakers today, there's a couple of quick announcements. Thank you to public radio station KLCC 89.7. City Club programs are aired on Monday following the Friday program at 6:30 p.m. on KLCC Radio. And thank you to Community Television of Lane County, Cable Channel 29, for televising recent City Club programs. Next week's program should also be a very exciting program, January 19th, Friday here at noon at the UO Baker Center. Three views on U.S. recognition of Israel as Israeli capital. So we're talking to three different people, one of whom was in Jerusalem when they made the announcement that President Trump made the announcement to move the embassy from Tel Aviv. So should be an exciting program. I want to thank everyone for coming today, and thank you to our two speakers, John Brown and Casey Houlihan. Thank you. Thank you. That concludes today's program.